Today's show is sponsored by Miracle Made. And oh my God, you guys, you know that I love a luxurious set of sheets. And I now have such a set of sheets because of a Miracle Made. They are bedding that has been inspired by NASA. They've got silver-infused fabrics that actually make temperature regulating a thing. So you're not like getting too hot or too cold or whatever, you know, the whole thing that happens with your body's temperature losing its mind. Miracle Made helps with that. One of the little things that my husband particularly loves about Miracle Made is that it like doesn't have as much bacteria as regular sheets because of it's infused with this silver that prevents up to 99.7% of bacterial growth. So it leaves the sheets cleaner for longer. And then the thing for my husband is that it doesn't give him acne, which is like an issue for some people. But more than all of that, it's just luxuriously comfortable and delightful. And it has that cooling feeling while also being cozy. Very hard to achieve those two things at the same time. I mean, Miracle Made, come on, well done. So here's what I think you should do. I think you should go to trymiracle.com/fakethenation and buy some sheets today. And if you order today, you can save 40% off. Use the promo code FAKETHENATION at the checkout and you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. So there's just a lot of savings here, folks. Order today, you'll get 40% off. Use the promo code FAKETHENATION. Go to trymiracle.com/FAKETHENATION. And Miracle's so confident in their product, it's backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you're not 100% satisfied, which I don't see happening, you'll get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/fakethenation and use the code FAKETHENATION to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/fakethenation to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode.
Fake the Nation, episode 210.
Hello, hello, this is Fake the Nation, where we talk about news, we talk about politics, and where we marvel at presidential candidate Kanye West. That's a real statement I just made, because America is fun. I am your host, Nagin Farsad, and today we're going to talk about some embarrassment that the president has unleashed on us, which is something I could say basically every show. We'll do a check-in on the state of Black Lives Matter and police reform, and we'll finally talk about the cancel culture articles that everybody else was talking about last week. I am joined. Oh, this panel is like a warm blanket on a fall's day or a gentle sprinkler on a summer's day is what this panel is. I'm so excited because they're both alums. I don't even have to host the show. Basically, I have two panelists that can just do the show and I could just sit here and enjoy the show. Coming to us for the millionth time, he has 4 albums on iTunes because he's a prolific motherfucker. I've seen him, I know I've said this before, but I've seen him kill all over the city, and it's true. I say it because it's fucking true. He has his latest album, which you should absolutely be downloading immediately. It's called 60% Joking. You can get that on iTunes. And you guys, it's Christian Finnegan. Hey, Christian.
Hi, Nagin. That was such a lovely intro.
Oh, it is all true. I am also joined by, to make this podcast a Persian sandwich, which is my favorite kind of sandwich. You've heard him on this podcast 1,000 other times. He is the upcoming host of Fraudsters, which is a podcast that'll be on Spotify. It's coming out before Labor Day. I'm counting down the days because this podcast will be great. I'm just certain of it because this guy is so fantastic. He's so funny. He's so charming. He's just a great chatty motherfucker. You guys, it's Sina Ghaznavi. Hey, Sina.
Hi, Nagin. Thank you so much for having me. Great to be here.
Let us launch in with topic number one. Okay, so this week we got a lot of Donnie. He was all up on the TV cameras, and here is one memorable moment from an interview he did with Chris Wallace.
I think it's the opposite. I think we have one of the lowest mortality rates in the world.
We're going to take a look. We had 900 deaths on a single day.
We will take a look.
This week.
Ready?
You can check it out.
Could you please get me the mortality rate?
Yeah.
Kaylee's right here. I heard we had one of the lowest, maybe the lowest mortality rate anywhere in the world. Do you have the numbers, please? Because I heard we had the best mortality rate.
The case rate of similarly situated countries, as Dr. Birx points out, and this is...
Number one low mortality rate. I hope you show the scenario because it shows what fake news is all about. Okay,
go ahead. Don't think I'm fake news, but okay. We'll put
well,
our
there you were.
We'll put our stats
you
on.
You said we had the worst mortality rate in the world,
I
and we have
the
best.
All right, it's a little complicated, but bear with us. We went with numbers from Johns Hopkins University.
Okay, so the Chris Wallace interview is just chock full of moments like that. It's really funny, especially if you're tired of rewatching The Office and you're looking for some other like 30-minute comedic programming. But that wasn't the only, you know, case of the Donnies that we saw this week. We also saw him restarting the coronavirus task force briefings, but with just him. So what did you guys make of this uptick in coronavirus and an uptick in Donnie this week? What are your takeaways?
You know, I think that one under-discussed aspect of this era is Trump as sort of the content generator in chief. You know, that we live in this world where there's just this constant grist of like, what's the thing we're all joking about? You know,
yeah.
And sometimes what you're joking about at 9 o'clock in the morning by 1 o'clock in the afternoon feels done already. And I will say, and I say this not even sarcastically, this dude knows how to just continue to churn out wacko moments. And I hate that that is so effective, but
he's a YouTube star.
Yeah, and I think that up until coronavirus, which was something you can't finesse, I think for a lot of people who aren't, you know, directly affected by Trump's policies, there is this sort of just constant, it's like a show that you can just watch and there's always a new episode. And there's, even if you hate him, there's always a new thing that you're joking about and passing around to your friends. And, you know, it's kind of a really awful aligning of the planets that the most, you know, verbal diuretic person in the history of the world happened to come along at the moment where people were as interested in verbal diarrhea. I don't know if that makes sense.
Cena.
You know what's funny?
Cena, your ways of saying diarrhea.
tasty. You know, I actually tried to watch this entire interview. Normally when I watch Donald Trump speak, I get triggered and I'm like, I get anxious and I can't go to sleep. I actually fell asleep to this entire interview last night. I watched, it was like a lullaby. That's where we are at in this entire presidency where I am so numb to it. It is like a smooth, like crashing water. Like the sounds.
it's your Headspace app.
Exactly. And it's like he shows up to an open book exam and he's like, no, I don't need the books. I don't need the books. And then he sees the question. And he's like, all right, let me look at the book. All right. Maybe it wasn't right. But then he doubles down and it says the wrong answer anyways when he sees it, that he's totally wrong. I mean, these coronavirus numbers, how many backflips can he do to try to run away from the fact that he cost thousands of lives? It'll just be a constant thing. And as Christian said, he is a constant engine of these wits or little absurdisms that he keeps trying to say. I honestly, not to go back to something I said maybe 3 years ago and a lot of other people have said, how this man is not on stimulants, I don't know. There is just no way he's not on something.
True. I want to point out too that this is just shitty gossip, guys. Because I oftentimes don't even really like cover these interviews or really, you know, want to talk about them that much because they're meaningless. I just did think this week we saw a lot of him and it felt like very. You know, it felt hard to not talk about. But the shitty gossip moment is he's really obsessed with talking about the cognitive test. And I don't know if in your slumber, Cena, you caught wind of the cognitive test. But that was only the first time he talked about the cognitive test this week. He's talked about it elsewhere. But basically, it was just like, it's a really hard test. And you would have probably, they're the last five questions. You probably wouldn't have gotten them right, Chris Wallace, you know. And I guess in the last five questions, there's maybe you have to repeat a series of words or something, and you have to like count backwards by 7 from 100 or whatever. And so he's talked about this now multiple times.
Yeah, he's upset. I've heard him talk about it at least 5 times, even before this week. And you know, he seems to think, and I'm not the first person to make this observation, but he seems to think that this is like an IQ test, and that if you do really well on it, it makes you exceptional. This is a pass-fail test that most elderly people have to take. You either are showing signs of dementia or you're not. And so, you know, we'll even if we trust him that he passed, which I don't, because it was administered, I think, by Ronnie Jackson, that what the doctor who said that he was like the picture of health and, you know, could bench press a Mack truck. But it's a pass-fail thing. You either get it right or you don't. There's no I did better than person X. It's like you either show signs of dementia or you don't.
He really does think it's an IQ test.
I think if you fail it, they'll still give you a driver's license.
I did really well in the test. Afterwards, they gave me a lollipop.
Well, I mean, it's also funny because the tenuous relationship between him talking about these tests is that it's a campaign strategy, because he thinks he can sell this point that Joe Biden has cognitive decline and that he doesn't, right? So I think that's like the idea behind him constantly mentioning it, is to point out some difference between him and Joe Biden. But it's interesting because I think the only thing it really does is to point out how much he's talking about this test without making the connection to Joe Biden, you know? I mean, obviously, he tries to make the connection, but I don't think that's what's sticking. I think what's sticking is, in like what was trending on Twitter, not that Twitter fucking matters, but one of the things that was trending on Twitter was like, one was the cognitive test, not that Joe Biden may be in cognitive decline. So, I mean, I think, and also this whole thing really about him appearing more, and he said that the coronavirus task force briefings are going to happen more regularly now, again, it's a campaign strategy. He can't do his rallies, so he's going to figure out these other ways to do them. By the way, when he was asked where Birx is, he said she was standing outside during the task force briefing, and Fauci, we found out later, was not invited. You know, his approval rating has fallen 28 points since March, obviously, because of his handling of the coronavirus. He now has 60% disapproval rating of the job he's doing. Will his reappearance on the public stage give him a boost? I mean, is this strategy going to work? It's week one, it seems like, of this strategy.
Well, to use a metaphor that maybe he would relate to, he doesn't have a whole lot of clubs in his golf bag, like strategically. It's like he has like a giant iron and like a putter, and that's it. You know what I mean? And so it's like he really doesn't have anywhere else to go in terms of strategy. And so it's like, I can try doing this press conferences. I can try not doing these press conferences. Oh, that's not working. I guess I'll do these press conferences again. It's not like he has any, you know, policy initiatives. I mean, the only initiative he has is to try to create chaos, you know, so he can have jackboots go cracking skulls. I mean, that's the only thing he can do to distract from just how completely impotent he is from a public health standpoint.
But Sina, this week he was also a little bit more serious about the virus. He said, it'll probably unfortunately get worse before it gets better. He was telling people to avoid packed bars. He was encouraging people to wear masks. He said he carries a mask with him and puts it on if he's in an elevator. Is that seriousness? First of all, what do you attribute the seriousness to? And do you think that's going to play or like actually help the situation from the mixed messages that we've gotten before?
I want to give the benefit of the doubt to someone in that administration showing him the numbers that his actions are killing his own voters. And they are actually fewer people, the people that are
for him,
that are anti-masking this whole thing, that are actually dying. That trucker from a few months ago that was a huge anti-mask advocate, Then a few days later, he got coronavirus, put up a video saying goodbye to his daughter, and then he passed away. There are people that drank this Clorox or whatever that are passing away that said Trump saw it on Fox News. Trump said it. Boom, boom, boom. It is like a clear cause and effect relationship. So he's got to see the numbers like, all right, all right, all right. So how can I just keep these people alive for another few months so they can just vote for me one more time? And then after that, he doesn't care. He is that selfish. I think that is the only motivating factor for this man, is to just try to get him some more votes.
I also want to point out, I don't want to overstate that he's more serious about it, because he also called it the China virus. And he, again, you know, that clip in the beginning where he said the United States had the lowest mortality rate in the world or whatever. He said that in the task force briefing too. So it's not, I don't want to overstate the claim that he's becoming more serious.
Yeah. He's becoming more serious in the sense that he's literally advising people to get into the lifeboats after the Titanic has already hit the iceberg. I mean, if you can call that serious.
I think it's a good time to go in the boats now. I think this is the time. Music, keep playing.
Meanwhile, Sina, that story about the trucker, the anti-masker, I did not know that. And that is
there's a few of those that are floating around now, granted, it's possible though those are anecdotal, and you know, I found that it was very interesting to me, and maybe I'm creating a connection where there is none, but right around the time, you know, a few months ago, that it became clear that the coronavirus was targeting people of color specifically, or that it was having a disproportionate impact, effect on Black and Latino communities, was right around the time that white people said, you know what, maybe we should reopen the economy, you know. And, you know, so it's like, I agree that he's jeopardizing his own voters, but I feel like the reason we've got at that point is because, at least in the early days when New York was the epicenter, a lot of the stories were about, hey, it's Black people, it's Latino people, it's poor people, don't worry about it, you know. And I think that a lot of people around America were like, oh, well, then what am I not getting my nails done for if it's just Black people dying? Like, I think there was this sort of attitude out there. And, you know, and now that it's finally moved into other parts of the country, I don't mean to talk about that like it's a positive thing. I think he can kind of clearly see, oh, this might actually be a negative for me electorally.
Well, and also the even stronger correlation to what you're saying, Christian, is that it hit Florida and Texas, right? And mm-hmm. he really needs those states to win. And then also we're now talking about Texas like it's in play, you know? Mm-hmm. So, and Florida is obviously swing states, always in play. So, you know, the gross other horrible thing is once coronavirus hits a state that you need, you need to keep those voters alive, and they need to see leadership from you. It's the way that in Massachusetts, there's a Republican governor, right? And he has a really high approval rating for the work that he's been doing. It's like a ridiculous percent it's bipartisan, because people just need to see leadership. They don't need to necessarily care about what the party of that person is. So we've seen that. We've seen that in Ohio, right? And so I think that's part of now I should show leadership, because apparently leadership is bipartisan.
Yeah. It's amazing to realize that like our measure of leadership now is just, can you deliver bad news like in a digestible way? That's it. That's all we need. Can you just give us some bad news straight up?
Digestible and also true. Facts. Yeah.
Cuomo, I mean, I cannot tell you. Like, everyone in New York has always been very on the fence or hated Cuomo, all this stuff. I've never thought he was like a big Democrat or anything like that. I always knew he was just like a Republican that liked to hang out and liked to help gay people get married. Great. Thanks. Thanks, Mr. Cuomo. But then when coronavirus hits, people are like, look at this stately leader. He shall lead us into glory. Just because he's like, everything is fucked. Everyone is fucked. It's bad. We got nothing. We're so unprepared. That's all. He just said how terrible everything was every single day.
We're like,
he's right. That's right. I like it. I like this guy. He's
straight. Let's throw on a fucking mask. Well, let's talk about the census really quick. Trump is trying to block undocumented immigrants from being counted. Guys, why on earth would he do that? It's so strange. It's obviously unconstitutional. So as a political strategy, and he's being sued left and right, you know, right? So like that, it's like, it's obviously unconstitutional. Article 1 actually gives the power to Congress, right? Not the president. That's ridiculous. The 14th Amendment, which ended the counting of enslaved persons as 3/5, goes further to require the counting of the whole number of persons in each state, right? So again, it's like unconstitutional in so many ways. Why is he doing this?
I mean, it's obviously this is like to rally his base. But what I find is that he always finds a way to live within his own hypocrisy very well. So if you think about it, he's going to try to reduce the number of people to get counted. So that changes Congress, that changes funding, that changes all these different things that has a cascading effect. But what he doesn't know, definitely, is that in the unemployment numbers, or rather the employment numbers, undocumented immigrants get counted in those numbers. Those are just surveys. So when he's going to spike the football about the unemployment rate is at the lowest it's ever, you're counting illegal immigrants in that number, jackass. You can't just spike the football in one place and be like, no, I don't want to count them in another place. He's cherry picking. And it's like, this is the kind of stuff that we need to tell people what he's doing so that the fraud that he is, is just very clear. And the scam that he's been trying to pull on us is so transparent.
Christian, I mean,
I agree. No,
I guess my question is, as a political strategy, as an electoral strategy, I think what's interesting about this is that I think the coronavirus is so big that it swallows anything about this kind of effort. I think, again, he's trying to do the 2016 playbook. Where he's like, don't worry, guys, I'm not including Mexicans in this, undocumented Mexicans in this thing, you know, and MS-13 and undocumented and stealing our jobs, right? It's like playbook, playbook, playbook. But I think in 2020, nobody gives a fuck about that playbook. Like that playbook, it's like having, you know, a huge policy stance on horse-drawn carriages. You know what I mean? It just feels extremely out of touch. Christian, what do you think of it as an electoral strategy?
Well, it's possible that the general public may not even be the real audience for this. If you're trying to shore up support within not just the Senate, but also the House and Republican parties across America, you know, if you're talking about reapportioning, you know, House seats, that is the kind of thing where if you've been really frustrated with Trump about how he's handled the coronavirus, that's the kind of thing.
I love really, really frustrated is like the nicest way of putting it.
Well, but I'm saying Republicans. If you're like a Republican House member from Minnesota or you know, I don't pick a state, and you're still pro Trump, but you're having a hard time making that argument when people ask you, and you're having a hard time feeling passionate about it. Well, if you're talking about, you know, getting rid of House seats from the inner city, you know, that go to Democrats automatically, well, then that could get me back on board. Like, that could get me back on the Trump train. Like, you know, that if you're throwing red meat to Republicans across the country, I just wonder if this is kind of a play more to shore up enthusiasm and passion from Republicans writ large, more than it is specifically about getting votes. And also just, again, I think that Trump believes, and I think there may even be a bit of evidence to support this, that his supporters feel excited to be on offense. They don't want to be on defense. They want to be on offense. And the thing they like to be on offense about the most is kicking the shit out of immigrants. You know, and
anything
you can do to indicate, hey, Joe Q voter out there, I am kicking the shit out of immigrants, that will at least make people who might be upset with you in other ways be like, well, on the upside, he is being terrible to brown people. So, you know, I'm for
right,
that.
Right, right. I mean, I can see that as like as a rationale, but I it's funny because I think there's a wonderfully conservative way of like spinning masks and as like pull yourself up by your bootstraps, put on your mask and protect yourself. You know what I mean? Like masking yourself is like arming yourself. I feel like there's a way of bringing in, I think this is not, it's like, I still think Republicans want to see leadership on coronavirus. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like leadership on, and look, I don't mean to downplay how racist we are as a country, because I'm sure you're right. A lot of people will be really excited by the inherent bigotry of plans like
even
this.
Even just the, but, the lizard brain part of people. It might not even be a conscious
thing. Yeah,
thought.
Right, just, right, right, right. Right, no, exactly. But again, I'm just like, conservatives, you're missing a huge opportunity to be have a wonderfully conservative selling point on masks and do your, you know, do your part or whatever, like a soldier, you know what I mean? It's patriotic. Like they love that stuff. Why isn't that, you know, I don't know. Anyways, I just don't understand why that's not a part of the, you know,
well,
the,
I mean, you're
the
asking
electoral discourse.
You know, people can say to me, Christian, you know what I would really love from you? 6-pack abs. I can't give them that. So I have to try to give you something else. You know what I mean? So it's like they can right. want leadership on the coronavirus from Trump till the cows come home.
Right.
He's incapable of providing that. So all he can do is right. provide him what he's more comfortable with.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. All right, you guys, you know what we'll do? By the way, I didn't mention this to the people, the Fake the Nation. There is construction sounds. Because they're doing something to like the third floor of my building that involves a jackhammer. So it's really difficult. And if you're hearing that, I apologize. There's nothing I could do because also I have to record from home. So anyways, apologies for the sound quality. If you're hearing that today, let's, instead of hearing more jackhammer, let's hear from our sponsors who keep the lights on here at Fake the Nation. We appreciate them very muchly. And when we come back, we will check in with Black Lives Matter. Today's show is sponsored by Prose. This is kind of, I feel like, you know, I'm on some sort of Lord of the Rings journey trying to figure out skincare. And I feel like this customized skincare line is really got my name on it. Basically, every bottle of Prose custom hair care and skincare, I tried the skincare just recently, is made to order and it's personalized. It's got a unique blend of naturally powerful and proven effective ingredients to meet your needs, like specifically you. And then the way they do it is you take this great, like in-depth quiz, basically. They analyze over 80 factors for a complete view of your life, your beauty goals. Like I have oily skin that's also dry, which is just a fun little conundrum. I live in New York City. Like we've got these four seasons. My face gets weird during seasonal shifts. All of these things I got to kind of talk about in answering the questions. The other fun thing was they asked us at the end, like, do you like a creamy type of moisturizer or like a less creamy kind? And I was kind of like, I think like less creamy. And they were like, that's fine. Like you can do that. But we think for your skin type, creamier is better. And I never knew that. So I love that there's so much kind of personal information that goes into creating this. I got my stuff in the mail very quickly after. I got a wonderful serum. Like I said, this very creamy moisturizer. And this also very just delectably creamy cleanser that just kind of feel like I think it's possible that I've been washing my face with just like harshness
like many years, because when I saw this cleanser, I was like, oh, is this what it's supposed to feel like? It's supposed to feel like a little bit of a delight on my face. That's not what I've been doing. So I don't know, guys. And here's the thing. You don't have to take my word for it. In a third party, double blind, dermatologist supervised controlled clinical study, which is like the gold standard for research studies, pros prove that personalization works better than off-the-shelf alternatives, which just sort of totally makes sense on a just logical level if you think about it. Just it makes common sense. Pros are so confident that you'll love your results that they're offering my listeners an exclusive trial offer so you can see the difference custom care can make. 50% of your first subscription order at pros.com/fakethenation will be taken off. That's pros.com/fakethenation. You get your free consultation and 50% off your one-of-a-kind formulas. Again, that's pros.com/fakethenation. Go and get your just super personalized, luxurious skincare products and hair care products. That's what I'm going to try next. So pros.com/fakethenation. I am the type of person that has subscribed to things and I have forgotten about those things. I have paid twice for a children's educational app and I didn't know that I was paying twice for several months. Until that is, I discovered Rocket Money, and because I use Rocket Money, it just showed up all these things. The thing that I was paying twice for that made me incredibly angry, thank God Rocket Money ended that for me. It also cancels the subscription for you, so you don't have to like go through the hassle of going to that site and figuring out how to cancel. They actually make canceling very difficult. I don't know if any of you have had the experience, but I have been on a like a roundabout 8 exit nightmare trying to unsubscribe to something before. Rocket Money eliminates that hassle. It also alerts you to an increase in subscription price. And this is something Rocket Money did for me. It negotiates a lower price for something you already subscribed to. So like for my cable bill, it got me a lower price. And I was very happy about that. Nearly 75% of people have subscriptions that they've forgotten about, which makes me feel better because I'm one of them. But it makes me feel terrible because what are we doing? Losing that money. I don't want to waste that money. And I know you don't want to waste that money. If you struggle with these kinds of purchases, if you struggle with finances in general, Rocket Money will help you with the budgeting, help you track your expenses, help you, like I said, cancel those unwanted subscriptions. It's a personal finance app that finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending. It helps you lower your bills so you can get back to saving. I mean, me and my husband have been on the warpath, and Rocket Money has been a really big part of that. It has over 5 million users with over $500 million in canceled subscriptions. The average member has saved up to $740 a year using the app's features, which is, I mean, that tracks for me. So stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions. Go to rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Again, that's rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Save the money at rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. What are you waiting for? Folks, I feel like I've mentioned this before, but I tried other services that I was displeased with. And then a neighbor of mine was trying Factor. I had pulled them aside in the hallway and I was like, what are you feeling about this Factor? And they were like, it is delicious. You should definitely do it. So then me and my husband did it and we loved it. They are chef-prepared meals that arrive to your door, and then in 2 minutes, you could be eating them. Like, it's so simple, and they're actually delicious. And for people like me who just sometimes, my schedule can be so maniacal between traveling in different cities and, you know, doing stand-up gigs. It's like I just don't have a typical schedule where I can plan, set aside time for cooking and all that stuff. So something like Factor really helps for me. The other thing thing that I love to do is try not to eat carbs. So they have a keto option, which is fantastic. It's super delicious. They use premium ingredients. You can get stuff with like filet mignon and shrimp and truffle butter and broccolini and asparagus, right? Like real ingredients. They're no fuss, no mess meals. They eliminate the hassle of having to prep. They're tailored to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with flexibility. You can pause or reschedule. I've actually done that. I've both paused and rescheduled. Factor is basically your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. We're celebrating Earth Day all month long, and look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals. So here's what I think you should do. I think you should head to factormeals.com/fakethenation50 and use the code fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's code fakethenation50 at factormeals.com/fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. And we are back, and we're ready for topic number two. So let's check in with Black Lives Matter, especially how it's playing out in Portland. So there's been protests every day there since the beginning, and now the federal government has deployed troops. Sina, troops in Portland, how's that playing out?
Well, you know, I think there's, well, one, it's poorly for the people of Portland. I think it's obvious it's not going so well for them. I saw some terrible, like, videos that look like it was, like, produced by, like, Steven Soderbergh or something like that. And it was just, like, low lights, smoke everywhere. They're, like, shadowy troops walking through these crowds and stuff like that. But the unfortunate part is because Portland is honestly so far away from any major media market, I don't think it's getting, frankly, enough of the attention and the traction that it should be. If this was happening in downtown New York City, it'd be global news. But it's happening in Portland, and I don't think it's getting, frankly, much. Maybe in like these like cable news circles, it's siphoning around a little bit. But I just don't really see the traction that it's happening. I think there needs to be a little bit more elevation of this because they haven't stopped protesting for weeks now. And it's right. been something to really marvel at.
I agree that in the last several weeks, it has not gotten any attention and that it was almost a surprise to most people, including myself, to know that it had gone on every single day. I think there has been an uptick of coverage, especially with the Wall of Moms. So the Wall of Moms basically showed up to stand, you know, arms linked between federal agents and demonstrators. So they were there to like stop the violence, and they were saying stuff like "Don't hit your mother" or whatever. And I was like, "Oh shit, the moms are out," and it made me feel a lot better because I was like, "The moms will sort this out, guys. let's everybody calm down. We've got moms here. It's going to be great." But Donnie called the. I think part of what's happening is like, what is the marketing message out of Portland? And so for Donnie and, you know, the right wing, the message is it's, quote, worse than Afghanistan, right? That what we're seeing in Portland is worse than Afghanistan. And I think it's true that there's been some episodes of violence in Portland, but by and large, it's just been peaceful protests every day. I think part of what's really remarkable is just the length of, you know, of like that it's been going on for so long. Christian, what do you think, like, what are voters hearing about Portland? Like, how does this affect them?
You know, it's really hard to know how this is going to play out, you know, and again, you don't want to strip everything down to voters and electoral systems and things like that. I mean, these are human beings, but I think that, again, Trump has a limited toolbox, and he remembers the Chicago riots at the convention in 68, and that helped Nixon get reelected. And he thinks if people see chaos on TV, they will want a law and order president. The difference is, of course, is that Nixon wasn't president at the time. He was running to replace LBJ. And also, it wasn't it may have been obvious to people who were savvy enough at the time, but it's pretty clear right now that Trump is the instigator of most of this violence. I think most people understand that these protests, while annoying and potentially maybe they don't agree with spray painting on federal buildings or pulling down statues or whatever, but I don't think anybody out there thought, oh my God, the Portland protest is going to come for me. You know, I don't think anyone was quaking in their boots, but Trump is trying to ramp this up. And you can see, you know, Ken Cuccinelli, the deputy secretary of Homeland Security, and keeps putting out these like tweets where we recovered this from protesters and, you know, the violence continues. And it was like a garbage can lid used as a shield and two gas masks. As if that was a sign. It's like, well, to me, those are defensive things. You know, those are things you get when you are being attacked, not when you're attacking people. And it's like they're trying to start a Reichstag fire, but they have wet matches. Like they can't get the rage started because they're incompetent morons.
By the way, I want to point out like a bit of the conservative response to what we're seeing. Ben Domenech, I never know how to pronounce that guy's name. Anyway, he said that saying, you know, that the federal, that the troops are increasing the violence. He said, quote, that's as ludicrous as saying that because there are a lot of firemen showing up at burning houses, that it was them that started the fire in the first place. I gotta be honest, as far as analogies go, I can picture myself being, you know, someone's mom and watching Fox News and being like, that's an excellent point.
Well, I guess the question that I would have about Portland still is, how much has the violence actually escalated? Because from what I've been reading, it seems like the violence has been pretty high. So the local police were doing their fair share of beating people up before the federal troops and stuff even started
coming
in. We're
beating people up.
We have a very militarized police system. So at least like there's a portion of that where I'm like, I don't understand what kind of analogy that even in what planet that's from, really. But what I do know is that there are all of these police that you may have one or two like lieutenants that are just like, all right, guys, we're going to keep it calm, keep the peace. And then there's like 800 guys that are like, we are going to beat some people up today. And they're excited about it. And you could see it very clearly in a lot of these videos. I don't know if you guys are on TikTok, but it's a great place to be right now.
Oh my God, Sina, you're such a TikTok evangelist. Every time you come on their show, it's TikTok this and TikTok that.
You know what? By the way, I brought it up so long ago. Now they're talking about close a TikTok down. So I'm like ahead of the game. I'm just saying, you guys should just jump on board. I know where it's at.
It's a site for espionage, Sina.
Whatever. You see me, I see you. What's the big deal?
By the way, I don't know what I'm talking about. I just saw that as a headline. So, like, do not go fucking read that yourself. I have no idea what that means. Continue, Sina. Sorry.
But, you know, if you really look at it, it's a whole systemic problem that we're facing. And it's like Portland is just this, I think, great standard bearer. They're carrying the torch still for a lot of other places that have had protests kind of died down. And frankly, that's what I'm happy about. You can see in Brooklyn here, like a lot of the protests have died down. There's just like cute bike runs that are happening now in my neighborhood. There's no more like down Flatbush Avenue stopping traffic and stuff like that. So I'm happy it's still going, but the violence has always
I don't want to look, the cute bike runs, I don't want to diminish those because they are keeping it, you know. I remember I came across a cute bike run a few days ago and in Manhattan, and I was like, thank you, like, because they're driving by thousands of people in their run and they're reminding everybody that Black Lives Matter, right? And so, like, it doesn't matter how small your protest is really fucking important, you know?
Also, I just want to say, like, what I want to say to people when they're watching, you know, when you were saying if you were at home and you know, the fire department analogy, and you think, oh, that's a good point. What I'd want to say to these people is, okay, this is clearly what you're seeing on TV, these images that are they're frightening. You'd like them to go away, right? You'd like them to go away. And ostensibly their answer would be yes. And I'd be like, tell me how that happens with Trump as president. Like, explain to me the process by which this goes away.
Right,
without
by which
millions
love
of people being hung in the town square. Do you know what I mean? Because I can tell you very clearly, I might not even agree with it, but I can tell you very clearly how it ends with Joe Biden being president. It's a very easy sell. It's Joe Biden becomes the sort of national healer, and he kind of gives a little to the left, gives a little to the right, and nobody's happy about it, but we all kind of grumble, and we go to sleep, and we are able to get a good night's sleep for the first time in 4 years. That's a very easy sell, whereas there is no sell for this ending under a second Trump term without utter blood in the streets. There's no way. There's no path to a peaceful future with Trump as president without serious carnage. Sadly.
And thank you for pointing that out, Christian. And I want to zoom out a little bit because a majority of Americans still support Black Lives Matter, right? At a record 69%. However, the public generally, this is from a poll I read in the Washington Post, the public generally opposes calls to shift some police funding to social services or remove statues of Confederate generals or presidents who enslaved people. This is a mixed message we're getting from the same poll. This defund the police, and it's funny because one of the funnier moments of that Chris Wallace interview was that Trump says that Biden supports defunding the police, and Chris Wallace is like, no, he doesn't. And Trump's like, no, he signed a manifesto with Bernie or something, which is what manifesto? What are you talking about? You know what I mean? Anyway, it was one of those fun moments from the Headspace meditation app that Sina now uses to fall asleep. So my concern was when we first talked about this weeks ago, the defund the police did not contain in it the multitudes that it actually does contain, just the as a branding, exercise. And I think that that's kind of what we're seeing. The defund the police isn't a clear indication. People are like, do I call 911? You know what I mean? Do I still get to do that? Do you believe that crime exists? Obviously, progressives believe that fucking crime exists. And I write about this in my next piece for the Progressive Magazine. Plug! But, I think that, that the problem is now that we've said this thing, defund the police, and that now, instead of explaining specifically what that means, and obviously it's complicated and we're still working out what that means, and Minneapolis is specifically working out what that means, which is fantastic. But now we have sort of let the right be they mean that there's that they want criminals to run around. So we're sort of letting them define the terms of the debate, after we said defund the police.
I mean, I can see it from either way, though, because you could also say it's a resetting of the goalposts that, people who are saying defund the police. Well, if I say defund the police and that ends up being watered down to mean we change the function of police departments and maybe we shift some funding around, well, that's a more successful outcome than if I said, hey, maybe we should reassign some police functions and move a little bit of money around. That gets watered down to nothing. You know what I mean? I agree that defund the police became a very kind of catch-all phrase that everybody just kind of started using 1 week without really thinking it through because it could mean different things to different people. It was sort of a straw man, like a positive straw man in a way. It was like a big tent sort of thing that people could say, and nobody really wanted to define exactly what that meant. And by the time we did, we being liberals writ large, by the time we did define what it meant, it was kind of too late.
Right. Sina, I wanted to ask you, because lest listeners forget, you have a law degree.
Oh,
what? Lest you yourself forget.
A good Persian boy.
He got it's we both did the same fucking thing, me and Cena. We got a bunch of degrees and then we went into comedy and entertainment like a bunch of fucking idiots. Okay. We're fantastic. So we read a piece in the Times by former prosecutor Paul Butler, and he said, blame the prosecutors, not the grand jurors. There's one reason that Daniel Pantaleo is not being charged in the death of Eric Garner. It's because District Attorney Dan Donovan of Staten Island did not want him to be. So his basic point is prosecutors are the main problem. This guy went in to be a prosecutor thinking that he could change the system from within, but it found out that the system had instead changed him, right? Cena, does that ring true to you as someone who has a legal background?
I have some friends that are prosecutors and stuff, and every prosecutor has their own discretion. But remember, they always have to, you know, talk to the district attorney, right? Like the head, the elected official of right. that area. So there's the Manhattan DA or whatever DA is kind of in charge for that jurisdiction. So there is a public kind of check on stuff like that. And so it is almost on us to really think more about those local district attorneys that we end up electing. You know, the judges or the district attorneys that you always see in those like midterm elections, if you vote in midterms, which everyone should be doing, by the way. And you're like, there's like 22 names on here. What am I going to do? I can't Google this many people. I've got 5 minutes. Got to get back on the subway. I've got to get to my next meeting. So it's all these things. But that's the trickle down effect of not taking more care into that. But I also think that is like, trying to put the blame in a very binary way, right? If you look at really what the defund the police conversation is about, the one not defined by the right, but the defined by more progressive movements, it's let's actually dismantle and reimagine what public safety is. That's really at the core of what we're talking about. Because for so long, you know, there's a police station in my neighborhood that was built in 1845 or something like that, something crazy. And I was like, was it the Civil War in 1865? And I was like, isn't this the exact problem that we're trying to avoid?
Are they using the same cubicles from the end of slavery? Yeah.
It's like, I get a new iOS update on my phone every two fucking weeks. We haven't updated the police department in 200 years. It's like, can we please just think a little bit logically about, is this the same way we want to keep each other safe?
Right.
And if so, then that actually translates into the prosecutors, it translates into the judges, translates into community policing, restorative justice, all these things that also get factored into public safety and kind of the more welfare type of things where we're like trying to get more mental health for communities, trying to actually create a better system where people aren't need to steal or feel like they're so oppressed right now that this is how the reaction occurs. Those are the things. It's not a binary situation.
Right. I mean, there's a few things that I've gotten excited about, though, just if we wanted to get like real specific. There's a few things that I've gotten excited about specifically since George Floyd, but even before that, back to Eric Garner, that I think would make a huge difference. So I'll advocate them now. The one is, I do think that prosecutors, their way forward is based on the number of cases they win, right? That's how they advance in their careers, is by winning cases. And winning cases does not mean figuring out the truth of what happened in a particular situation that involved or may not have involved a criminal act. Right. So those things are at odds. Like what the justice system is supposed to determine is justice. Right. Like it's supposed to serve justice. It's not supposed to serve wins and losses. And then someone gets to advance in their career because they like got a bunch of wins.
Yeah. It's not like a legal hot dog eating contest where it's like.
Exactly. That is how our justice system is currently based. It's based on the July 4th hot dog eating contest. And that's
Joey
not
Chestnut that... for the people. Nom, 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 nom.
And that it doesn't make any sense, right? Because that doesn't, it's like whether or not you won or lost makes no difference into whether or not this crime happened and this person was the criminal or not, you know? So that I think is, we need to move away from this winning or losing structure into a, we are all here and we're not even called prosecutors or defenders anymore. We're all literally just here to figure out the truth of the situation.
That Paul Butler piece that you're referring to was written in 2015, which of course is still completely applicable now. But I mean, even just I am not one of those people who thinks Law and Order was a good show. I had a lot of smart people I know are obsessed with that show. God, I've always thought it was garbage.
I never watched that show. Yeah, never ever watch it.
But still, though, if you just think about how that show operates, you know, what does the intro say? Like, there are two things that, you know, the courts and the police,
boom.
You know, that they have to work in Congress with each other. And so it's not only just that they have to win these cases, they have to win these cases with the help of the police department. And so, you know, you can't go hard at these guys who theoretically you're going to need their help to win your other cases. And so, I think I agree that it's not a binary thing that if you fix prosecutors, then you don't have to deal with the police departments. They're two separate problems that both deserve attention. But I do see his point, though, that, you know, you can't have these cases being adjudicated by prosecutors who have a vested interest in not pissing off the police department. you know, I mean, that seems like a no-brainer to me.
There's a great documentary called The Edge of Democracy about Brazil and kind of the rise of Bolsonaro. And one of the things is they had in Brazil were all these different investigations that happened, and they were trying to root out corruption. And one of the things, speaking of prosecutors, was the lead prosecutor that was in charge of the big investigation to oust the former president arrested the former president, and then, like it was a 90s sitcom, turned around and said, "I am now also the judge of this case." And so he's like, put on his judge hat and then adjudicated the thing.
I think it would go a little something like this.
So in America, it's like,
he puts on a mustache.
Point, we got to separate and have more maybe autonomy with the prosecutors so they're not almost as influenced as the police. And this whole commingling thing, great if you have a shared Slack channel. But come on, you guys have to get together and be more independent.
No, exactly. It's a So I would really love to see a change in that. And again, I think that's attainable. Like, I think what we're talking about is eminently attainable. And the other two things that I've been really excited about is I feel like we need to have more investigators and like maybe fewer people in the field because and just as a personal anecdote, we in the neighborhood, there's like a little bit of a drug dealing situation that I find a little menacing. And so we've reached out to the police department and we're like, "Hey, drug dealers, what's the deal?" You know? And they were like, "Right, we're going to get, a detective to get back to you." And we're like, "Cool, when is that going to happen?" And they're, you know, we're thinking between, he's going to say something like between 24 and 48 hours or whatever, right? He's like, "Oh, I don't know."
No.
And I'm like, "What do you mean I don't know? Like tomorrow, a week from tomorrow?" And he was just like, "Yeah, we'll see." And then it's been 2 weeks and I have not heard.
Well, I mean, this is all part of the plan,
too. And the problem is detectives are historically underfunded, and then the field officers are the presence of field officers are overfunded. And so this becomes a mismatch of needs, right? That's one thing I would love to see change. And then the second thing I would love to see, the third thing I would love to see change is I think people want police presence. They don't want police brutality, right? So I think, like, when you think about the women's marches, there were tons of police at the women's marches, but they were mostly chilling, right? They were just sort of on the side. And I think part of it is that it was a lot of women. Da, 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 da,
They weren't protesting like the police. You know,
we're not right. There's a whole right. I mean, there's a lot of different reasons, but I remember thinking as I was doing the women's marches that like, oh, I think this is the kind of thing we want. We want presence so that we get a sense of like, this is not going to devolve into chaos or whatever, but we don't want them. What people don't want from the police is stopping and frisking and racial profiling and all of the other shit. Right. But I do think there's like, obviously, for some people, I think the problem is police presence has turned into police menace for communities of color. That's the thing, you know, for white people, police presence doesn't necessarily mean menace, right? So we need to also work on like having those two things, you know, merge so that everyone views police presence as we're here to prevent chaos and not physically do anything to you.
I mean, the problem is that every time...
Does that make sense? I'm not trying to diminish anyone's, you know, fear of the police, which is super fucking real.
Well, there are so many small, you know, things, small by comparison things that we could do that most people agree with. You know, that most police officers should live in the cities where they are working, you know. Mental health checks shouldn't be performed by armed officers, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
But the problem is that anything that is suggested that kind of nibbles around the edges of police reform, the police unions and the, you know, people on the right will paint that as complete anarchy. They want to defund the police. They want to get rid of, they want to abolish policing. And so I can understand from a left perspective, it's like, okay, anything we suggest, you're going to call abolishing the police. So fuck it. Let's just abolish the police. You know what I mean?
Right.
You're going to call it that anyway.
And there is this kind of snapback too from like the eight can't wait policies that came out that Obama and a bunch of celebrities supported and stuff. And that came around a very similar time of like the fund the police. And like that kind of, I guess a little bit of what you could call it incrementalism, if you will, that actually puts probably more funding in police was kind of like allergic to a lot of progressives. And they're like, you know what? Fuck this. Defund the police. We don't need to give them more money so they can get beefed up to know how to do an arm bar instead of a chokehold. No, we need to like actually rethink this. It just really gets back to like the why. Why do we have them? What is their purpose? What is their goal? And like presence and the feeling of safety is what is really most important, not the running people down and you know, all the other stuff.
I like that. It's the presence and feeling of safety that we want to achieve. We don't want the menace and the brutality. And I think it all goes back to the fucking precinct in your neighborhood was built in 1845. we need to like just take a sec to like rethink it. All right, you guys, we are going to move on to topic number three. So a couple weeks ago, Harper's published a letter on justice and open debate that was signed by a ton of fancy public figures like Malcolm Gladwell and David Brooks and I don't know who else. And it makes a case that we have weakened our, quote, norms of open debate and toleration of differences in favor of ideological conformity. But they basically make the case that, and again, I'm quoting here, institutional leaders in a spirit of panicked damage control are delivering hasty and disproportionate punishments instead of considered reforms. And they list all of the ways in which people are, you know, editors are being fired, books are withdrawn because of inauthenticity, journalists are barred from writing on certain topics, et cetera, et cetera. The list goes on. So they made this case, I guess, and then there was a response for it to that piece in Harper's. But first, what were your initial reactions to that piece in Harper's, Christian?
Well, I don't know. I just can't imagine looking around 2020 and thinking this is what's important to talk about right now. You know, I mean, this needs to be said. The word privilege is like almost a nonsense word at this point. It's thrown around so much, but how just completely absent you are from the struggles that people are facing that this is what you're going to be focusing on right now. And I think there is sort of a knee jerk. Listen, we all understand that there is what it's like to get a bunch of people online mad at you. We all understand that sort of gut feeling, like when you say something online and people start coming at you and you open up Twitter and it's just like people, you know, women more than men, obviously. But everybody understands that that is an unlikable, gross feeling. And that it, I guess, if you're going to list, if you're going to make a list of problems, that would be on there somewhere, you know, but it's probably in the low 70s of things that are really affecting the day-to-day person. Of course, it affects the people who signed that letter because they're journalists or, you know, they're writers and they're not used to having that kind of immediate feedback from everyone, even, you know, even 10 years ago, it's like, okay, I wrote some article for the New Republic that people had a problem with, the Atlantic or what, you know, I'm catching maybe on the message boards, but if I don't go to the message boards, I don't even have to see that stuff. Or maybe there's a few letters to the editor that are printed that are scathing, but not when I go to just check my daily social media, which is, you know, where I go to see funny videos of dogs and all these things. And now I have 50 people calling me an asshole or a racist or a sexist. I understand that that might feel problematic to you, but get a fucking grip. Get a fucking grip. The house is on fire.
I disagree with you. I mean, I agree that the house is on fire with more. It's funny because I think on one show I said something like, I don't even remember. Oh, it was about the ERA. And I was like, I guess if I had to choose between the ERA and the climate crisis, I would choose the climate crisis. But we don't have to choose. Like, this is allowed to also be an issue. And I think the reason why it is an issue is because it is, the interface is with every single man, woman, and child, right, who has access to the internet. Because we all feel the, we all feel the rage. We all know that at any moment we could be canceled at any, in any age group for having said anything, even people with very, very small followings to large followings. So I think the entire concept of the public forum has been, you know, magnified so intensely that everyone is now in it and could be complete, could be canceled, which is why I think it's not, you know, a silly thing for us to think about or talk about, because it, it, it does feel constant. It, and it also feels like we're all in it. Sina, what were your initial reactions?
Yeah, initially I kind of was with Christian. It's like we have better things to talk about now, and but thinking about it more and kind of looking at some of the other people that signed on, Kareem Sarjapour is this Iranian advocate activist that's on here as well, who I know and love. Wynton Marsalis is literally a musician, so he's like, you know, Noam Chomsky. I mean, it's not, this is not even like a right or left type thing, right? This is,
right.
I think there is a huge amount of privilege that's involved here. But what I kind of always go back to are like two big things. One, we, you know, I don't know how you guys grew up, but where I grew up, everyone was always like, you shouldn't talk about religion or politics. And those are the two things that we have more fights about in this country than every anything else that we could possibly imagine. We have run away from having uncomfortable conversations, and we have socialized this entire country to not have the literacy in having those uncomfortable conversations. I want to have uncomfortable conversations all the time, to the point where when my wife and I, when we used to go to dinner parties, would be like, can we please not? Can we just please not tonight? And it's like, those are the things that I look forward to doing. And the other thing is, a lot of the cancel culture leads to us not getting like the solutions that are actually for our most long-term benefit for the things that we're trying to do. For example, like there's a city in Florida that was called Plantation, Florida, that I think is changing the name from Plantation to something. Fantastic. That is great. I'm all for that, you know? No problems here. But you know what would be a lot better? Is if we didn't code race into our zip codes, so that if you're a black person, you go get a mortgage, you're going to get a subprime mortgage because they know your zip code, they know what race you are, and they're going to give you a terrible mortgage. That leads to terrible lending. That leads to you not having equity in the very neighborhood that you're trying to invest in. These are like tough concepts sometimes to kind of wrap our brain around, but I don't want us to have a party because we changed, we took down a statue or changed the name of a city when we have huge equity issues in this country where like you have like zero people of color on boards across the country. And yet we're going to take down these statues. We are not done yet. So whether or not this kind of this letter addresses that, I think it kind of is, kind of doesn't in a way. And I think there is a little bit of like, I want to write whatever I want and you have to like it. There is like a lot of that that I feel from like, especially David Brooks, like David Brooks signing onto this is very frustrating for me. I wish he may did not invite him to sign it. But a lot of the other people, I feel like there's a huge amount of room for us as a society, especially in this country, to be able to grow and have these tough conversations and make fun of each other like comedians do. This is why we all like hanging out with each other, is because we all like being able to say whatever we want and be able to send and receive all kinds of different pieces of words and not necessarily, and know that we're all in this together to try to make like things better, right? And be funnier, frankly.
Yeah.
I mean, artists, comedians, might feel some sort of pressure, feels like, you know, in a way, Christian, you're right. It feels like, who gives a shit if you feel a little pressure about, you know, censoring yourself a little bit? Like, fucking who cares? Like, that's fine. But I do feel it so much more now. Do you?
Well, of course we all feel it.
Do you feel an aversion? Right. So you feel an aversion, and has it changed anything that you would fundamentally say or do?
But, to me, it is purely a function of technology and how society engages with technology. It's not some political revolution that's happened or some devolving of public discourse all on its own. It is 100% a function of people having a way to communicate, often anonymously, at every moment of every day, the minute a thought comes through their heads. You know, and a lot of times, I may be mistaken about this, but I'm of the belief that a lot of these people that are coming at you, trying to cancel you, it's not really about you. It's all about them branding themselves. It's all about everyone, look at me taking down so-and-so. Right. You know, and once you...
But the real life consequences are that so-and-so gets taken down.
But who's gotten taken down? I mean? Who really has gotten taken down that hasn't deserved it? Do you know what I mean? Like, who are the people that have gotten taken down?
Okay. I think Al Franken got taken down, and I don't know that he deserved it.
Okay. I mean, again, though, that wasn't, I mean, I don't know if that's the kind of thing, is that the kind of thing this letter is trying to address? It doesn't sound like it to me.
Right. It sounds like op-eds. You're right that the letter, it's funny because I think there's like two things going on. The letter is trying to address like whether or not, you know, writers and journalists and whoever feel like sort of comfortable speaking their mind. But I think the thing that it doesn't talk about is it's really not about them feeling comfortable. It's about the social media apparatus that whips people up into a frenzy and then forces the institutional, the people in charge, to like fire those writers or, you know, and then it leads to people self censoring.
But I mean, this instinct has always existed. It's just that we have a facility with it now. I mean, you know, ask the Dixie Chicks about that. You know.
Right.
Obviously, it's stained Bill Maher's soul for the last 20 years. You know, his show getting canceled, and now he thinks that's the most important thing in the world because it happened to him. But this stuff has always happened. The only difference is that now we have technology to bitch about it constantly. And also, I think when we use things like, you know, whirl people up into a frenzy, I actually don't think that people are as frenzied as it looks in print. They say, fuck you, you should die in a tweet. But meanwhile, they're playing with their dog while they do it. You know, they're walking down the street on the way to grab lunch at Potbelly Sandwich Works. You know what I mean? Like that, this frenzy, when things are put into print, we have this idea that it takes on this seriousness and this fury. But I really don't think that that's true. I think a lot of people are just going about their lives like, oh, hey, what do you want at lunch? Oh, wait, well, let me send this tweet. Fuck you, die. Anyway, so where should we get lunch? You know,
That's my favorite way to tweet.
Well, and I think though that the fuck you die goes back to Cena's point about literacy around we are not, so for whatever reason, we've lost the ability to have nuanced conversations, you know? And that I think is the problem with fuck you die. It's not specifically that tweet. It's that the tweet is trying to suppress nuanced conversation.
Well, as a society,
always,
I think we've all become way too addicted to dunking. Like that has become the be-all end-all. That it's not really about having a conversation anymore. It's like, who can deliver that oh shit moment?
yeah, totally. I should mention, so then in the objective, there was we've made some of their arguments already. There was a response piece to that letter that came out. And I'll just quote from it. The content of the letter does not deal with the problem of power, who has it and who does not. Harper's is a prestigious institution institution backed by money and influence. Harper's has decided to bestow its platform not to marginalized people, but to people who already have large followings and plenty of opportunities to make their views heard. Ironically, these influential people then use that platform to complain that they're being silenced, which I think is, you know, kind of goes back to your first point, Christian, which is that, like, okay, famous people, you're so silenced. Yeah. You're so marginalized, which I'm of two minds there, which is they, you know, they are self-centric. And I think the Al Franken example is a good one because for me personally, because I kind of remember at the time feeling like I had to be on board with a burn it down. He should go. Oh, my God. Kill that guy. It's over for him and all men. Like, I felt that pressure a little bit. And if I succumb to that pressure, I'm not proud of it. But that pressure is this thing that we're talking about. And I'm sure it functions on everybody where they might abandon their principles a little bit, you know what I mean? Because they're afraid of the internet. Even in the last segment, when I was saying we want police presence, not police brutality, I then had a fury of worry in my mind that, oh my God, I'm going to get canceled because I suggested that police could be a good thing that we might want. You know what I'm saying? I am still worried about how that sentiment is being understood because it's not something that can be that could be commented on, I think, usefully in a tweet. It's not a conversation that could be usefully had in social media. I think it really requires a conversation like what we're having.
I do agree that, you know, nuance is verboten and that there is an appeal. And again, to me, this is a product of social media and how it's warped our interactions in general more than any sort of political movement happening right now, is that there is, if you express any nuance, you are leaving your flank open for attack from people who really just want to attack, you know, who just want to snipe, you know. So if you say, you know, unless you're either saying A or Z, if you say any letter between A and Z, you are then leaving yourself open to be dunked on by somebody who's just looking to dunk. And I'm not going to say dunk anymore.
It's funny because I know that's like a basketball reference, but to me, it's a donut reference.
Dunking on? That sounds delicious.
Oh, look at how much coffee got on that donut. Like, that's how I took all of that. Sina, what were you going to say?
But I was saying, like, what we're seeing now is even to that point of, like, who has power now. What's interesting is that, like, these groups, especially in, like, academic institutions where universities are becoming more like corporations now than ever before, you have bureaucracies that are becoming powerful and that those are the ones that are creating a sort of power dynamic. They're creating the oppression over certain types of speech or certain types of thought. I mean, I was in college opening for like Daryl Hammett or whoever would come to town in college.
Brag.
And hello. he still partied then, so it was fun. But he was like, they would censor me. I was like, I'm a student here. You can't censor me. These are my jokes about my experience in my life. And they were censoring me. And so this is happening, whatever. I'm not even going to talk about when I went to college. But I mean, that's how long this has kind of been growing and developing. And I think when we talk about power, we have to start to talk about collective power that's happening and what that means. And if it asserts a binary, again, that's exactly counterproductive, counterintuitive than what we want initially. A lot of this stuff, people should go. Harvey Weinstein, glad he's gone. Bill Cosby, glad he's gone. A lot of these other people, you know, shouldn't be around anymore. Al Franken probably should have taken his hits and stayed in the cut. Taken a class or two, apologized profusely, done all of these things, would have still had him in the Senate doing his job. You know, that's the kind of balance that we have to find. Also, Christian, fuck you, die.
All right, guys. Well, do you have closing thoughts from Christian Finnegan?
I had it and now it's gone. Fuck! Gosh darn it. I was going to say that one problem that I don't hear people discuss, and again, it's because of social media, is that we live in this world now where 22-year-olds hear and have opinions on what 52-year-olds say. That has never been the case before. These two groups of people would not interact. There's no reason that a college student should know what the fuck David Brooks is talking about unless you're a weirdo. You know, and vice versa. These people should not be hanging out at the same party. You know, all of these conversations 20 years ago would have happened in isolation and nobody would know these things, you know? And so, of course.
Segregate the generations.
Yes.
That's, you're right, Christian. Nobody's talking about that. All right. Well, before we end the show, I want to tell you guys about a really exciting race in Ohio. Thanks to one of our listeners, Ohio's District Number 10 is now represented by Mike Turner, who our listener deemed despicable, and is supported by, has supported the Trump agenda. He's opposed the right to organize. He's opposed a $15 minimum wage, restoring of the Voting Rights Act. He's opposed aid to Puerto Rico in the wake of the hurricane. He just sounds like a terrible guy. He represents parts of Dayton, or I guess the entire city of Dayton is in his district. Now, his challenger is a young African-American woman named Desiree Timms, and she endorses workers' rights to organize, healthcare, justice, women's control over their own reproductive over their own reproduction, and ending gun violence. She's been endorsed by E-Dubs, Lizzie Warren's guys. I don't know. I haven't looked into her, but look into her. If any of that piques your interest and you live in Ohio's 10th, and please keep the races coming. I love to hear about them and to tell others about them. In closing, Sina and Christian, I would like for you to tell listeners briefly if there's anything that's making you hopeful, putting you on the spot. Is there anything in America right now that's making you hopeful? It can be dumb or grand.
Well, should go ahead.
No, you go ahead, please.
Oh, damn. Well, I was just, I'll go with, actually, I know we made fun of the younger generation and stuff, and they shouldn't be at the same party, but frankly, the number of young people that I've seen in Brooklyn here, and like, I'm on Washington Avenue, and I see the protests when they were happening a lot come up right my up my street. And it is so exciting to see all the young people that are very aware of all of the issues that are happening today, and they're very conscious about it. And there's a sense of community there that I know my generation didn't have, because we were too busy like doing whatever the fuck we wanted and being entitled and blessed, and like this world was supposed to be ours. But it's that's what's giving me hope, is that these young kids, they know what they're doing a little bit more than we do.
Christian, is there anything that's making you feel hopeful?
Well, I want to say for the record, you know, as a 47-year-old childless comedian, I'm not welcome at either of those parties, either the 22-year-olds or the 52-year-olds, because I have not the adult concerns of the 52-year-olds, and I'm not cool enough to hang with the 22-year-olds. But I would say, and this might sound a little bleak, the thing that gives me the most comfort right now is that nobody knows anything. Nobody knows anything. That the die is not cast and things change constantly. You know, when I think about, you know, reopening and what my industry is going to look like in the future, and it's very easy to feel pretty dark about things, but nobody knows shit. And so just kind of buckle down and take care of yourself, and let's see where we stand 6 months from now. Sorry, is that too dark?
No, I mean, I think just to give another clause to your sentence, nobody knows anything, so your ideas might be fucking great.
You know, there we go. That spins solutions. It nicely.
And I the thing that really gave me hope this week, that just like, I think I've been seeing headlines every day and it's been making me very like feel very warm about the future of the country, is the Wall of Moms. I know I already talked about them, but the Wall of Moms in Portland. Wow. How fucking inspiring is that? Fantastic. Taking matters into their own hands, putting themselves in harm's way in just, I think, you know, the most inspiring way. So it's so great. We have people that do that, guys. We have people that do that. How cool. How cool that we have that in this country. People that would do that. All right. Sina, where should people find you and all the things that you're doing?
You can find me on social at Sena Now, SeenaNow, on Instagram and Facebook. I'm Sena underscore G on TikTok. You won't see me. I don't know. I just look at kids play pranks on their parents and look at police brutality videos, unfortunately. So, and then Fraudster's coming out. I actually just got word August 27th. It's coming out on Spotify.
August 27th. I'm so excited.
So pumped. Thank you.
Christian,
Well,
where do people find you?
After all my railing against social media, you can find me on Twitter at Christ at Christ Finnegan, because I am of the world, even if... and if you are in the New York area, where my wife and I are trying our very best to keep QED Astoria afloat through these lean times, and we've been doing live shows, socially distanced live shows out in the backyard at QED, Thursday through Sunday. And so if you're in New York area, specifically the Queens area, check out QEDAstoria.com.
Oh my God, absolutely go to QED Astoria. It's fantastic. But also, a socially distanced show in a backyard is all the more sweeter because it's just so difficult to achieve. You know what I mean? To get that live comedy in a socially distanced setting, it's a feat unto itself. So it kind of feels like you're a part of something really like amazing. You can say, I was there in 2020 when we were doing socially distant comedy shows at QED. All right, guys, you know where to find me and all the stuff that I do. By the way, I was on last week's episode of Love It or Leave It. I don't know if I mentioned this last week. I don't think I did. But anyways, it was a real fun one. And it's still pretty relevant. So check it out. And I'm going to be on upcoming episodes of other things. It doesn't matter. And I have, stuff coming out. I'll let you know. If I remember, I'll let you know. But what I would really like to do is thank the people that make this show a possibility. That is our wonderful producer, Anita Flores, our talented audio engineers, Andy Christens and Kate Moldenauer. Gabby Alter wrote our theme music, and Lily Fleschler helps out with research. We love to hear from you, Nation of Fake the Nation. Send us your feedback, topics we should be chatting about, guest ideas you might have. You can leave us a voicemail at 331-901-0005 or drop us a line at comments@fakethenation.com. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts because it helps people find the show. That is a real thing. And your races, your competitive races, what are they? Hit me up, comments@fakethenation.com. That is it. We'll be back in your earballs next week. Thank you.